tough congressional look at the budding Space Force and an experienced hand chosen to lead Air Force acquisition. Two of the top stories on Defense Front this week. Most urgent, perhaps, though, is something of a budget crisis for the National Guard. For more, Federal News Network's Jared Serbu and Scott Mossioni. And Scott, we'll start with you. The National Guard has looks like a $500 million hole it's in as a result of the Capitol Hill protection ensuing from January 6th. This budget they spent is more than just on that day alone, isn't it? Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, this storm has been something that's been brewing for quite a while now, and the National Guard has been warning about it, and Congress has been trying to fix it, and they've been trying to do it in multiple ways with standalone bills, with bills that are in more omnibus sort of fashions, and then also the Defense Department's been trying to do it with reprogramming. However, it just has not gotten through Congress. And now if the National Guard does not get its funding by the end of this month in July, then it's looking like they're going to have to start stopping some of the work that they're doing. And that work, I mean, by doing drills, they're going to lose maybe 2 months of drill pay for people. They're going to not have to do some of the flying hours. And then obviously this has a trickle down effect in terms of troops and their families are going to start incurring debt to the government because of life insurance and TRICARE insurance that gets taken out of their military pay. National Guards have those, you know, deductions for blended retirement systems, which means that they're not going to be able to put that money into the retirement system that they thought that they would before. And, you know, this can continue to cascade as things go longer and longer. Right now, we have these, we've seen that Defense One reported that General Hokanson, who is the National Guard Bureau Chief, sent a memo to the heads of the Air and National, the Air and Army National Guards, ordering them to pull back all unspent federal funds from the states so that they can just really remain solvent and keep doing really just the mission that they want.
The response that they had to the insurrection at the Capitol, then it went beyond that day.
It ended up being about 5 months, and those 5 months of just guarding the Capitol, looking into threats that were coming in, all those sorts of things. And there were threats that they had to stop. You know, after the January 6th attack, we've now seen that this ended up causing a lot of money. And this is something that the National Guard, it comes at a year when the National Guard had more troops deployed than any other time since World War II. You have to remember they were right, working on COVID, civil unrest, January 6th insurrection, and then all the regular things that they do, wildfires, hurricanes, and everything else in between.
Plus, they're getting increasing demand for cybersecurity remediation from state and local governments.
That's right, and even space as well. So they really call themselves the Swiss Army knife of the military, and they certainly showed that this year.
So they're looking for reprogramming if they have to, which is still a big budget shortfall, or ideally they would like an additional supplemental appropriation to cover that. Is that what they're hoping for most?
Exactly, and we saw one of those pass the House. It was a $3.7 billion really national security sort of thing that would protect the Capitol. It had to do with the investigation into the January 6th attacks as well. That ended up not making it into the Senate. There's also a standalone bill that comes from Representatives Wambach and Calvert that we don't really know what it will turn into. However, there's large support for it. And then we have Senator Leahy, one of the chairs of the Senate Appropriations Committee, has put his bill in, another one of these more omnibus sort of bills around this as well. So plenty of opportunities for it. It's just a matter of getting it done before the August recess. And there's a lot of other things that Congress has on its plate until then.
Sure. And also, speaking of Congress, Scott, you are reporting that there is a pretty tough critique of the Space Force now in its mere 18th month. What is the issue here?
If you remember back to why the Space Force was being created, it was because the space forces and the space acquisition and everything else around the organization around space within the military was very decentralized. Now this military branch, which was created to centralize these sorts of things, is in its 18th month of existence. And the Congress is saying, where's the beef, if you'll excuse the old phrase? They really want to know what is going on and why they haven't seen the centralized, especially when it comes to acquisition. Now, one of the things that they're trying to create with this and what is legally supposed to be created by October 2022 is in Space Acquisition and Integration Office. And that is something that has not been created yet. However, Congress is looking at this and saying, all right, we need this before next October, because this is something that, as the Space Force is growing and creating more of a presence, it needs something more centralized to get this acquisition moving and going faster, especially now that Space Systems Command is starting to set up, which is in charge of the acquisition and fielding of space equipment.
And that's a good transition to Jared Serbu, who is writing about an acquisition pick for the Air Force and some other holes in DoD nominees. Jared, what's the latest there?
The latest is that Andrew Hunter, who is now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is going to be nominated to be the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. Andrew's name should be very familiar to our listeners and readers. He's quoted fairly often as a sort of acquisition analyst in many of our stories and many other news outlets' stories. He has experience in the Pentagon and in the Capitol Hill on acquisition issues. Most recently, he worked in the Pentagon as Chief of Staff under Frank Kendall, when Frank Kendall was the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. And now Frank Kendall has been nominated to be the Secretary of the Air Force. So they would be working together once again. I say would because we're still waiting on a confirmation for both Mr. Kendall and a bunch of other DoD nominees. The Biden administration, as far as the Defense Department goes, has been relatively slow getting some of its sort of lower tier nominees through the Senate and even just nominated. Frankly, they were pretty quick getting a secretary and a deputy secretary confirmed. But as of now, the acquisition positions throughout the department are pretty thinly staffed. The service acquisition executives for the Army, Navy, and Air Force are currently all led by career civilian officials. So is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment. There really are no Senate-confirmed officials serving in acquisition positions right now in July, which is fairly shocking.
Yeah, I guess it's easy to run uphill about a quarter of the way, and that's where the administration start to slow down a little bit. And also, Jared, I wanted to ask you about the cooperation agreement between the Department of Defense and Homeland Security on cybersecurity, and that's something of a stall, too.
Yeah, this is an observation by the Defense Department's Inspector General. We don't have the full details on what their concerns are because part of the original report was classified, and we've really only seen a redacted version. But their concern is that the most recent joint agreement between DoD and DHS as far as how to cooperate together on cybersecurity is not being implemented the way it was written. That agreement specifically called for the two departments via a joint steering committee to develop milestones and plans of action for how they would implement several different lines of effort that were specifically called out. And that really has not been done, according to the Defense Department's Inspector General. For DOD's part, they say that this was really just supposed to be an informal agreement to promote engagement and define areas of common interest. But as the IG points out, that's not what the agreement said. And they really need to formalize some of these structures instead of depending on informal activities that are kind of worked out at the senior leader level, because those leaders, of course, can and do change.
And this, as the cyber situation itself becomes more dire, and there is more use, as we mentioned earlier, of the National Guard at the state and local level for cyber, so it would seem like something they do need to up their game on.
Yeah, that's right. And we may find out more about what these concerns actually are between the two departments, because this was a joint audit between the DoD Inspector General and the DHS Inspector General. We've only seen the DoD side of things so far. A DHS version of this report is still forthcoming.
Federal News Network's Jared Serbu and Scott Massioni, their latest DoD Reporter's Notebook, now online at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy. with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and where, what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing, and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect, perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, WAPA serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler. And to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast, we'll see you next time.